Good morning. I'm Charles Somm. I'm the Institute's Deputy Director of the Center for State and Local Leadership. Thank you for joining us this morning. Josh Greenman is going to moderate our panel on discussing teacher evaluations and how to break the deadlock. Josh is the opinion editor at the New York Daily News. He oversees the op-ed page, sits on the editorial board, and writes occasional columns, including many thoughtful ones about education reform. He served as a speechwriter and policy staffer for Mayor Giuliani and Senator Lieberman, and he also, in a previous life, worked as for a nonprofit called the Teaching Commission, working on education reform. So with that, I will hand it over to Josh.
Thank you. We're going to try to keep this moving and have a thoughtful conversation and then open up to some questions at the end. We're going to have brief opening remarks from each of the panelists, and then we'll have a conversation. First is Mark Sternberg. He's Deputy Chancellor for Portfolio Planning at the Department of Education, City Department of Education. He, prior to serving as Deputy Chancellor, founded and served as Principal of the Bronx Lab School. So I'm just going to kick it over to Mark, and then we'll keep going.
Thank you, Josh. And thank you, Charles, and to the Manhattan Institute for bringing us together this morning. Let me just build on the comments by the Chancellor very briefly to reemphasize a few things. One is that this is mission critical for the Department of Education, and we think for New York City. This is also not a fire drill, and I would say that from two perspectives. One, as the Chancellor eloquently reminded us this morning, the stakes are high for financially for schools. Schools have experienced, unfortunately, a set of cuts over the last several years for reasons that we all know about, and this would be a very hard next cut for schools to experience, and we all have a shared obligation to do everything we can to avoid that. I would say substantively, in addition to that, the stakes are high because of what we are all here to talk about, which is teacher effectiveness. You know, if college and career readiness is the goal that we all care so much about, then this work, building a reliable framework for teacher development at the school level, is how we're going to get there. And many of us have seen what schools are like when that framework is not in place. You know, I started my career as a Teach for America core member in the Bronx at Community School 66, and was surrounded by well-meaning educators who worked as hard as any of us could have asked them to work, but without a real sense of leadership and without a framework for how they were going to develop as teachers. And if I was successful in starting a school on the Evander campus, the Bronx Lab School, it was because I worked to build a culture that was different than that I had experienced as a teacher, a culture that valued instruction, that put a conversation among adults about what good instruction looked like at the heart of the school. And that is true if you walk into an urban assembly school. That is true if you walk into Democracy Prep. And that is true of good schools everywhere, here in New York City, in Newark, in Los Angeles, anywhere in the world. When adults are having conversation about good instruction, good things are happening for students. And that is the heart of what this negotiation is about. And there's broad agreement about many of the fundamentals here. And critical negotiations remain underway, and you'll see Dave Wiener today, who's going gray by the minute as he navigates those negotiations. But this is not a fire drill. This is financially critical for our schools. This is substantively and spiritually and instructionally the future of education in New York City, and so we're very committed to seeing this through. The Chancellor spoke briefly about the pilot work in New York City. I think this is not news. We've talked about this before, but I think it bears emphasis and repeating. You know, today, 200 schools, what began as a pilot of 20 schools is now a pilot of 200 schools, experiencing and implementing the beginning of the teacher effectiveness work. The data coming from those schools is encouraging. It shows us that principals are spending substantially more time in the classroom talking with their teachers about instruction. It shows us that teachers who overwhelmingly have told us that they are dissatisfied with the current evaluation framework are, 4 out of 5 of them, telling us in these 200 schools, these 10,000 educators are telling us that they are getting valuable, timely feedback about their craft. And they are getting better at what they are doing as a result. We've seen a 15% increase in these schools in teachers who, at a preliminary level, are effective and highly effective. This is not insignificant. And I think this leads to my last point, and then I'll look forward to Marcus and Aaron's comments. Much of this conversation over the last year has been framed about clearing out bad teachers. And undeniably, that is a part of this conversation, importantly. And I would submit that that is a shared value among the partners who are negotiating this deal. No one wants an adult who does not belong in the classroom to be there. I would say that adult should not want to be there. But this is about building a culture and a climate that values good instruction. And what we know in New York City from our work over the last decade is that a school that is focused on building the structures that lead to that kind of adult interaction are places that breed good instruction. And again, that is the heart of this negotiation. I would submit that that is the heart of 3012C, and that is why I will, I gather, be clearing my calendar until the 21st of December to get this deal done. So look forward to your questions and to the conversation this morning.
Thanks, Mark. Marcus Winters, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and assistant professor at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. He's written a number of things on this topic, including some thoughtful pieces for the New York Daily News op-ed page, which I highly recommend everyone in this room read on
a regular
basis.
That's where I send the good ones. All right, well, thanks a lot, and thanks for everyone to be here to talk about this really important topic. I mean, I think so, just to start off, I want to point out that, you know, there are really two reasons why we're interested in this discussion. I think both of them are important, right? There's the immediate problem of, you know, a lot of money is tied to this right now, so a deal has to be struck at a given deadline, and I think that's something that, you know, the chancellor hammered home, and is something that is, it's why it's on our desk right now. But there's also this bigger question that I'm going to focus a little more attention on, which is that it's probably the right thing to do for kids too. That this is good policy and something that we want to do in order to ensure that high quality teachers are in classrooms, and we really shouldn't lose sight of that. So why do we need to rethink this system? Well, just briefly, the reason for this is that we know empirical research over the last several years has shown us what most parents, what everyone works in public schools already knows, which is that teachers are extraordinarily important. They're the most important school-based factor for producing student achievement that a school has at their disposal. We also know that teacher quality varies dramatically. So the difference between the same student being assigned to Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Johnson down the hall can realistically mean a grade level's worth of learning for that student in any given year. So there's wide variation both across schools and within public schools in teacher quality. Meanwhile, we have an evaluation system that tells us that all of those teachers are equally effective, that does not meaningfully distinguish between the great teachers, the really bad teachers, and all of those teachers in the middle. The evaluation system does not help us to distinguish who are the teachers that we want in the classroom and who are the teachers that we don't want in the classroom. And we need an evaluation system that does that. And a lot of this discussion about creating a new evaluation system has focused on the component of using test scores to evaluate teachers through, you know, what we call value-added models. This takes up a lot of the discussion, even though it's, you know, only part of the evaluation tool, in part because it feels foreign, particularly for teachers. From my perspective, the main question to ask about value-added is there information in value-added that helps us to predict which teachers are going to be effective later on? And in fact, we have a lot of empirical research, including some of my own, indicating that, yes, there is, in fact, information inside a teacher's value-added score. So if we take a teacher's value-added score, so I have a paper for the Manhattan Institute recently, if you take a teacher's value-added score earlier in their careers, that's going to help us to predict how much the students in that teacher's classroom are going to learn a few years later, right? There's information information there that helps us to identify the most and least effective teachers. Now, it's not perfect. There's a lot of noise in that system, and that's something that has to be taken seriously. But there's information there that the current system is leaving on the table, and we need to start taking advantage of it. In fact, value add is a much better predictor than anything else we use today to try to identify who's going to be effective later on. What can we do with good evaluation systems, you know, once we have them? So I think one thing we can do, and as Mark said, and I agree, it's a small component of it. We can hopefully identify teachers who are really ineffective and should be removed from the classroom. I will say I do think that that's an important part of it. I don't think it's really all of what's going on here. I think it's actually a small part of what we think the overall effect of these policies is going to be. That said, I mean, I guess depending on where we set the standard, no one in this room would be comfortable sending their child to a teacher who, under the new system, is going to get two bad evaluation ratings in a row, which is really what the new law is talking about. And so we shouldn't feel comfortable sending everyone else outside of this room's kids to those teachers either. And we need to have a system to identify them and remove them from the classroom. But as importantly, one problem with the rubber stamp evaluation system that we have now is that it provides no meaningful feedback to teachers about how well they're performing relative to their peers and how they would actually get better. And that's something that we need an evaluation tool that can do. Now, value added can only do part of that, and it should not be used exclusively to evaluate teachers. And I don't think anyone who works with these models thinks that it should be used that way. We also need meaningful subjective evaluations of teachers as well. And that part of the evaluation system has to change also. The days of the fly-by principal evaluation that just says, yeah, you're doing just fine, without a meaningful, you know, real look of what's going on in the classroom, have to end in order to inform these evaluation systems as well. So the reason we need this, I think, is because we need to take advantage of, right now, the most important factor within a school is something that we're not taking seriously, the evaluation of it, right? So teachers are the most important factor within the school, and we have a school system that doesn't take seriously trying to figure out who are the great teachers and who aren't. And I think where we've been moving is in the right direction to try to right that ship.
Okay. Finally, Aaron Powles is professor of sociology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. He's held a number of other teaching jobs, and he was a statistician at the National Center for Education Statistics at the U.S. Department of Education. He's also written a piece I would recommend everybody in this room read called Meet the Worst 8th Grade Math Teacher in New York City, which was published on the Hechinger Institute website and then later on the Washington Post. Aaron.
For a long time, I thought that there were four major purposes to evaluation processes in schools: certification, selection, direction, and motivation. Certifying individuals as having a set of competencies, selecting them for future opportunities, which in the case of teachers might be performance pay, you know, bonuses, or at the other end of the spectrum, separation, removal, firing. Direction, helping the people being evaluated have an understanding of what's important, providing direction about what to attend to in the work that they're doing. And motivation, using evaluations that have consequences to try to motivate people to be successful. What's generally missing from that framework, I think, is a sense of evaluation for capacity building. Maybe it's an element of the selection process of selecting people for opportunities for professional development, but I think that's a really important function of evaluation, and one that I think is critical to the development of a new teacher evaluation system. The real tension, though, I think, is among these different purposes of evaluation and the possibility that the kinds of methods we use for trying to promote one of these objectives might be in conflict with another. And I think that, the biggest challenge that's facing the system right now with regard to developing a system that's viewed as legitimate has to do with its function for selection. I think that that's true both for the use of value-added measures of teachers' performance, where there are questions about the reliability and stability and validity of those measures, but perhaps less discussed, but even more important, I think, pertains to the questions about the procedural challenges involved in implementing a system that seeks to evaluate teachers' classroom practices through observation. We've got ways of measuring teachers' contributions to students' test scores, and Marcus and I can duke it out about their details and their strengths and weaknesses, and we might do that in the next period of time. But the other challenge, and this is something I'm sure that Mark can speak to with regard to the pilot work that the DOE has done, is building the capacity of educators in school settings to be able to evaluate their peers and the teachers who work with them. There's a tremendous challenge in developing strategies for observing practice that have a shared vocabulary where everyone understands what's important and can recognize what's important. And what worries me greatly about this is that New York City has 1,700 schools, a lot of inexperienced principals, and is moving, as many states and districts are, in a headlong rush to implement a system that requires building the capacity of hundreds and thousands of educators to do this kind of observation work. And although there are frameworks out there, I mean, many of you in the room have heard of the Danielson framework, which is the dominant framework, there's evidence that even with lots and lots of training, many principals never get to the point where they can do evaluations in a reliable way. The Measures for Effective Teaching project headed by Tom Kane that the Gates Foundation is operating found that 23% of the principals that participated in that study had to be excluded from observing teachers' practices because they couldn't get to a point where they were reliable in doing so, even after 25 hours of training. So I think that from the standpoint of educators and the public, questions of fairness are really central to this discussion about what this teacher evaluation system should look like in the future. Can we get to the point where all concerned can view the system as fair? Because if we don't view it as fair, it's not going to be legitimate, and it will never work the way we want it to.
Okay. First question I want to put to the group. I think there's an inherent tension in a lot of these conversations we're having between systems, right? Chancellor Walcott talked a lot about replacing one system with another system, judgment, the judgment of hundreds, thousands of individual professionals throughout the New York City public schools. And by that I mean, you know, we heard Seth Andrew talk about the way they use evaluations in democracy prep schools. There was a very, very thoughtful Deborah Kenny op-ed talking about some of the dangers of using a one-size-fits-all rating system throughout the New York City public schools. My question is, but all else being equal, is it better to rely on the judgment of individuals, principals, throughout the system, or to try to impose a single means of evaluating every teacher when most conservatives, I would say, they tend to believe that individual judgment is where you ought to put most, and understanding that people will make mistakes sometimes, that individual judgment is where to put power, not with some kind of abstract system dreamed up in a central office.
So let me take a shot. And I will, in respond to your question, respond, Aaron, a little bit to some of your comments, which I thought were very thoughtful. And I think you're right to worry about the extent to which this framework is one that builds capacity of adults. You're right to worry about whether principals in schools have the tools that they need to give timely feedback, accurate feedback, feedback that's going to move instruction and move achievement at their schools. We worry about that all the time. And if this is going to be successful, it has to be, as you put it, capacity building. It has to frame conversations in schools and provide a context for the interactions that adults have that forces real conversation about quality instruction. Josh, to your question, I think that invariably, and I say this as a former principal, the quality of those conversations will be deeper and richer when it contemplates multiple inputs. I would have been a better principal if I had systematically, as we hope principals are doing in the pilot schools, we know they are, and hope they will system-wide very soon. Would have had better conversations if I had sat there systematically with my thoughts and feedback on the Danielson framework next to the feedback that the data provided about their performance and how students were moving or not moving, and had a conversation over the course of a year, over the course of several years with my staff. That would have been a better and deeper and richer conversation that would have been more likely to move instruction for those educators. And so one final point, I think Aaron questions how fast we are moving here, and again rightly points to the risk here. What I would simply respond to that with is, you know, what is inherently unfair is a system that tells 98% of teachers that they are successful without any real anchor for providing substantive feedback.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't in any way attempt to defend the system we have, but one thing that I'll ask, and Marcus and Aaron can speak to this, is, you know, we have very, very high-flying charter schools, and they do not use a system imposed upon them from above, right? Seth schools don't use that. Deborah Kenny, who talks about a teacher in her school who would have probably performed very, very well, but just wasn't working out, would have looked very good under the system imposed by the Department of Education if she were subject to that system. She decided to get rid of that teacher. Aaron has an example of another teacher who performed very, very poorly, at least on the value-added component of that Department of Education imposed system, and that teacher was known to be exemplary inside the school and by the principal and by all the parents. So how do you balance that?
Well, as far as the balancing, you know, so a teacher shown to be bad on value added or you know, good on value added unnecessarily, I mean, I think the having a meaningful subjective component to the evaluation, the idea of having multiple measures is that we have several different times, chances to look at teacher effectiveness. So, and value added has some, we probably shouldn't duke out the statistics for this crowd, but you know, it is a noisy measure of quality. It's certainly not perfect, and something that subjective evaluation should be able to come in and identify cases where it's got it wrong, and there's going to be more than a few of those cases. So that teacher who shows up really badly on value added but is actually really effective, you know, hopefully their principal identifies that, and the 60% that's not value added is going to end up higher for that teacher. I mean, more fundamentally to your original question, I mean, I think that you're right. I mean, in an ideal world, you know, all public schools would operate the way that SES schools do and a lot of the high-functioning charter schools do. I think that's a much bigger discussion, though, that has to be, you know, in the context of a very large public school system with lots and lots of schools and lots of people, you probably need a single evaluation tool that people can turn to as a constant. So, yeah, I mean, so my own kind of priors would be, I would love to have principals to have, you know, full autonomy over these things. I could see, you know, why some teachers would be, you know, a little nervous about that. And I think, you know, having a system for a system is probably a good idea. I also think, you know, and just to say, I mean, I think a lot of cases, so a lot of teachers are worried that principals will misuse their power, which, you know, back a long, long time ago, principals, you know, did, you know, just looking back historically. Now, that said, I actually do think for a lot of those, you know, teachers who are worried that their principals are going to single them out and remove them because they're the, you know, rabble-rouser in the school, a lot of them are going to look at value added as a really nice thing, that they can point to it and say, look, I'm actually doing really well. When you consider, you know, an objective measure of my performance, and make that part of my evaluation tool. So in order to improperly remove a bad average teacher for having a bad evaluation rating, the principal would have to be seeking them out for a bad performance, and they would have to, you know, randomly get a bad score. And I think having those multiple measures help to pull that in.
I think we're asking a lot of principals to expect them to ignore the powerful and articulate voice of Marcus Winters about the importance of value added as ways of reducing uncertainty about teachers' performance. Because when a principal like Mark is juxtaposing the value added data on his left hand and his observations on the right, there's a tremendous pressure to have the subjective observations shift to align themselves with what's being presented as the scientific evidence about effectiveness. That's a real worry. How is it? Can we trust principals to be able to somehow not be influenced by their knowledge of the value-added performance when we're being told just how relevant and important it is by people like Marcus?
Next question I want to ask, and let's keep in mind through this whole conversation, when we talk about value added, we're talking about 20%, maybe up to, theoretically, depending on how this is used, 40% of a 100% evaluation. And even still, we're talking about 20% of the teachers, right? So 80% of the because it's only teachers in tested grades and tested subjects that actually have a value-added component. Now, maybe that'll grow over time when we get different kinds of instruments for measuring student progress. But and Mark can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But what I wanted to ask is, there's another consumer of the system, which is parents. And we have this dynamic where I would say the more sophisticated a value-added instrument gets, the more difficult it is to understand that value-added measure. And I've looked at these formulas, and they're really hard to understand, right? You look, there are all kinds of coefficients, all kinds of numbers, and you have to be a statistician to know what is going on, and teachers are being compared only to teachers with similar populations in their classrooms, and with students who start at the same place academically. How do you resolve that, deal with the fact that the better your formula, the harder it is for parents and teachers to grasp?
So I think you're right. There's a natural tension here, and it can't be totally resolved, right? I mean, so, and we can't really expect, I think it's important to try to explain to teachers as best as possible, you know, how this evaluation tool works, but explaining it's a three-stage HLM with this and this, is you're not going to get very far. So there is this kind of natural tension between something that everyone understands and something that actually gives us as precise as we can measure of their performance. I mean, I can see both sides on this. From my own perspective, I think we should err on the best evaluation, the closest evaluation of their actual performance as we can get, and then make the case to teachers and parents that, look, this is something we think about seriously. We understand it's not perfect, but this is our best measure of the teacher's effectiveness, and the way you make this measure go up is you get your students to learn more. I think you can't make that tension go away, right? The statistics aren't going to get easier, because people's actual performance and lives are on the line here. I think it's important we get the best measure that we can get.
Well, the best measure is fine, but I think a real challenge is recognizing the uncertainty that's inherent in those best measures. New York State has now released this year's version of value added, the student growth percentiles, statewide. New York City didn't release them directly to their schools and teachers, but they're now available on a state website, and other districts around the state have had them since August. And I was corresponding with a teacher in upstate New York who was rated as being at the 39th percentile. That is, on average, her students scored at the 39th percentile of other students who were rated, who started the year with similar backgrounds and test scores. And that gave her a score of 5 out of 20 on the state's 20-point evaluation system. But there was a lot of uncertainty in that 39. It could have been as low as 32. It could have been as high as 45. And a 32 would have rated her ineffective as a teacher. And a 45 would have rated her as effective. She was actually in the developing category. So there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, we go with the best evidence. We look at that number, this teacher is developing. But just by chance, the same teacher, by virtue of the number of students she taught and how varied they were in their backgrounds, could have been rated ineffective or effective. And we need to have a system that acknowledges the extent of that uncertainty and not to rely too heavily on the specific number that pops out of this black box computer that Josh and others are a little fearful of.
So can I just make a point related to this? So I think that's right. I mean, and so one of the difficulties is not only the exact statistical model, but to say that number we get, right, those of us who look at statistics know that number we get has some error built around with it. And I think that's something that needs to be explained as best as possible to teachers as they look to their own evaluation rating and also to parents. You know, that said, I think it's important to also keep in mind that even though, you know value-added and whatever, you know, system we're going to come up with, there's error built into that model. The current system is also riddled with error. The only difference is that the current system, when it errors, it errs to always identifying a teacher as effective. And that errs in the interest of the teacher, often against the interest of the individual student. So we're never, ever going to come up with a perfect evaluation system. I think it's important to try to come up with the best system that we can and understand that it's imperfect and work from there.
Yeah, a few quick points here, consistent, Marcus, with what you're pointing out here. You know, very basically, multiple measures. Right? The teacher's evaluation is not going to be solely formed on the outputs of the value-added score. And we have an obligation to educate teachers and students and parents that is the case. But we would be wrong to ignore this data, and we would be wrong to not think carefully about how we share it and how it is incorporated into the feedback loop that principals have with their teachers. To your question about specifically about parents, you know, I dropped my 6-year-old first grader off at school this morning, and I'm a happy man. And he is spending 6 hours a day for 10 months this year with Ms. Sharon, who is God's gift to first grade. And she is I have spent enough time with her at First Fridays, where I get to spend an hour in her classroom, and enough time with my son and watching him learn to read and learn numeracy and explore the world of knowledge, to know that he is in extraordinarily good hands. And Marcus pointed out earlier, it is not okay for me to be happy about where my son is and his teacher, when we know that so many parents don't feel that way. So let's not underestimate parents' interest in a framework that leads to a better teacher core. And let's not underestimate parents' desire to know the quality of teachers, even when it does not present the full picture. Even when we have this obligation to educate the city about what the data tells us and doesn't tell us.
I'd like to know a bit more about the evidence that parents think that their kids' teachers are inadequate. I think that that's actually, for the most part, not true. And one of the things I worry about is Chancellor Walcott spoke quite warmly about the history of teachers that he personally had experienced as a student growing up. Keep in mind that probably half of those teachers would be rated below average on value-added measures.
Let's talk a little bit about what else goes with this rating system, because we're not talking about having numbers in isolation. I think particularly for the teachers in the vast middle, because this evaluation system is best, I think everybody admits, at the top, at the very top, and at the bottom. It tends to be most reliable at the very top and at the very bottom, and people can take issue with that if they want when they're answering. But in that vast middle, with say 80% of the teachers who are rated decent, how do you build an architecture that helps them get better and that rewards them, not just in kind of end of year bonuses, you know, Wall Street style, but really encourages them to become masters of their craft over the course of a career and stay in the profession if they show promise so they don't leave quickly?
A few quick points here. First, I think it is worth mentioning that the mayor and the chancellor have advocated and continue to advocate for compensation for highly effective teachers, $25,000. They've been public about that. And we think that is an important policy initiative, and we are still fighting for that, and and I think it is an important element to, Aaron, to your point, to selection, you know, to keeping great teachers in the classroom, and we can all agree that all teachers deserve to be compensated, especially when they're doing outstanding work. So we continue to advocate for that. My other response to your question goes to some of my comments, my opening comments around a culture of instructional conversation, of inquiry. And what we have seen in the pilot in these 200 schools, these 10,000 educators and 100,000 students is that teachers, again, are more satisfied with the feedback they are getting because there is a framework for the conversation. There is a structure. There is an expectation that principals are looking at this Danielson rubric and they are discussing openly, transparently, clearly with their staffs what their expectations are. And they're not just talking about it. They're rolling up their sleeves. They're getting in the classroom. They're looking at multiple data points. And they're having real conversations about what's working and what's not working. And that is what a good school looks like. And Cy will affirm that point of view. Cy knows what a good school looks like. And he knows that is, you know, anywhere in the city, in the country, where adults are having deep conversation about instruction that is data-driven, instruction is going to move. And so we see a 15% increase in effective and highly effective teachers in our pilot. I would say critical that those conversations aren't just taking place, but that they are structured around a shared language and that they incorporate data from multiple inputs that, are shaping these conversations and moving practice.
So, I think there's a lot of different ways you can kind of structure a differential compensation system, and they have different pluses and minuses to it. But I do think the general principle that great teachers should be paid more money than our bad teachers, I think is an important one, right? So as I said in my opening comments, that we know that there's large variation in the quality of teachers, and yet, so we not only evaluate them as being the same, we pay them on a lockstep system that's based on two criteria, experience and credentials, that we know is just really not related to how effective they are in the classroom. And really what we're talking about is just changing the general framework. I think Mark talked about this a little bit, this general framework of how we consider schools, right? That the idea that your actual performance really matters. And that should have consequences. Not only, one should have consequences if you're really bad, we should be able to identify that and just get you out of the classroom. But if you're really good, we should be able to identify that and reward you, right? The benefit of that, some benefit could be it kind of incentivizes people to get better in the classroom. I actually think the much bigger benefit of that's going to be is that you're going to increase the probability that you keep around the teachers you want to keep around, without also increasing the chances you're going to keep around teachers you don't really want, which is the problem with a lump sum pay system. Is just a higher pay is just as attractive to bad teachers as it is to great teachers. And as we move more towards a system that first recognizes who's good and bad and then acts upon that information, I think is always a step forward.
I'm amazed that Mark and Marcus are championing merit pay in the U.S. when there's no consistent evidence that it works. I would put my money on capacity building, and I think that principal leadership is central, and I think that there's pretty clear evidence that keeping effective teachers in the classroom is most likely when a school is led by a principal who can serve as an instructional leader. That's one of the things I worry about in New York City, which has opened more than 350 new district public schools over the last 9 years. The talent pool for principals is pretty thin. I mean, it's kind of a hard thing to say, but it's true. And we're counting on these principals to serve as instructional leaders, often in settings that are serving very challenging populations of kids. They're not attractive places to work, much more so than worrying about $25,000 bonuses. We need to worry about making these schools better places for teachers to work. And I do think that principals serving as instructional leaders can help with that.
I'm going to ask one other very quick question, and then we're going to open it up to the room. Do you have in your mind, all three of you, a number or a range in terms of removing the worst teachers? We remove, I don't know what percent now, it's a very, very, very small number, you know, in any given year. Is there a number that healthy functioning organizations? Should we think, oh, if 5% or 6% aren't being tagged ineffective any given year, then something is wrong with the system? Or is this a bell curve, or is this an kind of absolute cutoff?
I do have that number in mind, and that number is the right number. I think that this is a mistake that we make too often. We make this a conversation about removing bad teachers. And Aaron, I'm gonna challenge you a little bit here, because this is about building capacity. And the answer you just gave strikes me as odd. These things are not mutually exclusive. Implementing a complicated, complex, multi-measure evaluation system will be new, it will be scary, and we acknowledge that. You are right to point out that this has to be about capacity building, and I would submit that when implemented, this will do more to build that capacity, to focus conversations on instruction, on the things that matter. And that's the data we have from the 200 schools that are in the pilot, right? Higher satisfaction rates among teachers, better performance among teachers, and better use of time by a principalship that is working as hard as we can ask them to work to build great school cultures across the city, in schools that we have started, in schools that predated us by decades. So the two are not mutually exclusive, and there's no evidence to suggest that they are. But again, Josh, there is a number. It's going to be 1% or X percent.
Do we know it's
high?
Do we know it's higher than it is now? I mean, is that by definition, if we're not firing more teachers than we're firing now, is that something?
I think that is a fair assertion. But I think we can all agree that the framework we have for removing ineffective teachers is outdated. The chancellor talked about 1935, and it is not conducive to building the highest quality teacher corps that we know we can build.
Anybody else want to hazard an
answer? I would say that I think that thinking about what this number might be is complicated by the realization that a great many teachers leave the system for reasons that are not due to being terminated directly due to performance evaluations. You know, close to one half of all teachers who are new to their New York City schools leave their buildings within 3 years. It's an extraordinarily high rate of turnover. And to be sure, some of those teachers are probably being counseled out because they're getting advice from their supervisors and their peers that they're not competent. But there also are a lot of teachers who could go on to be terrific teachers who are leaving prematurely. And I think the system needs to think about that as well, and I know the people in this room are thinking about that, but it does complicate trying to figure out what the right number of teachers to terminate through an evaluation system might be.
No, I agree with that, and I think that, and I mean, not only do we know that it seems to be related to quality, right, where a lot of the very worst teachers are leaving on their own, which complicates the effect we would have from a just firing policy, but which is why I think it's important that this is not a just firing policy, and one of the things that you do is you provide information about effectiveness to people, and hopefully they get better because of it.
Okay. Who has questions in the audience? Start with.
I'll handle the question. Okay. We've got a lot of smart people here. Why don't we start with the incomparable Saul Stern?
So I'll date myself a little by saying that I started writing for City Journal about the rubber stamp evaluation system and the fact that we don't fire bad teachers in 1996. So I'm all in favor of a better system. The problem, and you've all talked about this intervention that the DOE has come up with, which we can compare to a medical intervention for some malady. The problem is all medical interventions, particularly medications, have side effects. And every smart doctor knows about the side effects. We are proposing, and you have discussed, a system of intervention without some of the prominent side effects, which may be worse than the cure. And I'll just mention two of them. One is teachers are changing the way they teach because they're afraid of being rated ineffective and are excluding, and there's a lot of evidence on this, are excluding in their teaching everything but what is going to appear on the next third or fourth grade state math and reading test. And the other very bad side effect, which could turn out to be worse than the cure, is an expansion of cheating. When you offer a principal a $25,000 bonus, particularly near the end of her career, which will go on her pension, and there is a tremendous temptation to fudge the numbers. I've written about this as well. The DOE does not have a good system. The state does not have a good system for rooting this out. Teaching scandals are just cropping up all over the country. So none of the panelists have discussed the side effects. I'd like to have some discussion. And what are the consequences?
I'd suggest Marcus or Mark, since I would imagine Aaron agrees with a lot of what you just said.
So there are side effects and there's these specific side effects that we're talking about here. So as far as outright cheating, I think can be, you know, addressed with you know, good proctoring, and, you know, we can do, you know, things like erasure analysis and things like that. It can't be completely gotten rid of, but the question is it going to be bad enough that it completely negates the system? And I don't think we've really seen that. As far as teaching, well, you introduced the question about teaching to the test, I think, in an interesting way. You said, you know, teachers are changing the way that they behave. And if they're changing the way they behave by making improvements to the way that they actually provide instruction, I think that's a good thing. If they're changing the way they behave by directly teaching to the test, then that's hopefully something that we can see, in the subjective evaluations as well, which is another reason why just focusing on an objective benchmark of a test is not the way to go. I'd also say, I mean, look, I mean, you're right. I mean, this is a limited time to talk about this. I mean, there are other effects as well, but I think a lot of them we hope we can't look at empirically yet. It's very difficult. But I think there's promising other side effects as well, as far as who decides to become a teacher in the first place. Entering into a system that's going to take seriously how well you perform, and staying in a system that takes seriously how well you perform. I think, you know, those are, you know, we might call side effects that are going to end up on the positive end here.
Okay. Let me jump in before Aaron gets started. These are good concerns, and you're right to raise them. I would ask you to contemplate the side effects of our current construct that are not considered side effects now, right? That are part of the air that schools breathe and have been for 60 years. And Saul, you've written eloquently about this for many years, so you know what I'm talking about. I agree with Marcus here, that we want teachers to rethink their practice in some cases. And that's healthy, and that's good, and that's what doctors do as science evolves, and it is what lawyers do as their practice grows, and it is what we want professional teachers to do. We do not want to suffocate great teaching, and we do not want to lose the joy of instruction. You know, and I think about my conversations with Ms. Sharon, right? Who is implementing Common Core now, and who is struggling to rethink things she has done well for the last decade? And my instinct as a parent is to be sensitive to your concerns, which is to say that I want to preserve all that is good, and I want Ms. Sharon to rethink things and to think about a classroom that's going to respond to new standards and to a new evaluation system. And these things have to live in balance. And balance, I think, is a good word to end on. And we have to maintain balance. We have to maintain the joy and what's good about so many classroom teachers across the city.
I would simply say that if we expect teachers to respond to evaluation systems as powerful incentives, then we need to build into them the things that we think are important. And right now we're in a point where the tests are the tail wagging the dog. New York City and now the state have hitched its fortunes to a state testing system that, although tapping important things, is a small fraction of the things that we want schools to do and the kinds of talents, skills, curiosities, creativity that we want teachers to inspire in students. If we don't find ways of measuring those things and building them into evaluation systems, it's inevitable that they'll be driven out.
Why don't we work our way back? There's a woman in the first row has a question, first table here.
My question is, Aaron and many of you talked about how important a principal is in the evaluation process of the teachers. My question is there in the pilot plan, is there a system for evaluating the principals? It seems important.
There is, and there's been a great investment in helping develop principal skill. Many hours, many days with principals during the school year, over the summer, in norming them around how to understand the Danielson framework and how to structure their work with teachers over the course of a year, how to sort of building inner rater reliability among principals so that we know both in a school and across schools, that the conversation about what quality instruction looks like is similar. Aaron has spoken about how difficult that is and how important it is, and he is right to do so. This is some of the most difficult and most important work. We are encouraged by the progress, but the answer to your question is absolutely yes.
Okay. Durrell in the back there.
Thank you. I want to make sort of a sporting analogy, and I think Marcus touched on this a little bit. So there's a lot of talk about coaching and execution and very little talk about scouting. You know, you can't coach height and you can't coach speed. So evaluation in a lot and helping people get better is a lot like trying to help lots of short, slow people get taller and faster. So would you speak to the other side of this coin, which is what's the systematic approach to make sure we get lots more tall, fast people into the system so that we don't have to spend as much time sort of using evaluation as a stick or as an exit tool, and we have more confidence in the fact that we're actually recruiting people into the system, you know, at the front end who are going to perform in ways that we'd like them to perform.
Let me try. I'll first challenge your sporting analogy a little bit in that, you know, as a principal, I saw teachers, novice teachers or veteran teachers, walk into my school and 2 years later, 3 years later, improve their practice dramatically. So I don't want to sell short the capacity that educators have to get good at what they do, like all of us, to make mistakes, to stumble, to be surrounded by adults who care about what they're doing and care about, you know, lifting all boats and building that community of collaboration and improvement. And I've seen it, and we're counting on it. And we cannot, certainly with the rules we have now that Marcus described around lockstep pay, and certainly with the current evaluation framework, we can't fully address the question that you're raising if teachers aren't going to get better at what they do at their school. You know, so I could describe, and others in the room could as well, all of the things we are doing to recruit teachers, whether it's the New Teacher Project or Teach for America or, you know, many, many vehicles, you know, Teachers College and the great partners we have in higher education in New York City. You know those things, and you can read about them. New York City continues to be a great place to live, and we hope always will be. And so people want to come here and be a part of something special. You know, two final points. One is that, again, the school, you know, we operate under the belief that the school is the unit of change. And the school is going to be a reason that a teacher improves. The school is going to be a reason that teachers come to New York City and want to teach here and get better here and stay here. You know, we think that this evaluation framework can help us make sure that happens.
So I want to challenge the analogy a little bit too. So just to the extent that it's not that we only have players that are short and slow, right? We have some really great teachers out there too, right? It's actually more like we went to the NBA, went to the AAU, right? And randomly put people, you know, on their teams. They're going to get some, you know, 7-footers that are really, really great. And they're also going to get some of the players who really shouldn't make it to the NBA. And I think that's, you know, a big part of the problem here is that we can't quite figure out how to identify effective teachers before they get into the classroom. And this is a problem. It's definitely a problem on its own, but it's an extra problem because there are barriers that we put in the way to become teaching in the first place. So I think the answer to that is we need to remove as many barriers as we possibly can so that people who might be great teachers are able to get into the profession easier than they would otherwise. And then after that, it's when the evaluation tool comes into play, where we need to increase the number of people people who could become great teachers, increase those numbers who enter into the classroom, and then focus our attention on figuring out which one of them, who among them are really great at it and who among them don't belong there. Right now, the system doesn't do that. Right now, the system focuses on setting these barriers and then essentially assumes that everyone's doing just fine, which is exactly the opposite of the system that we want.
Can I follow up on that? Because I think Darrell made a really important point, and Saul's talked about this also a lot, in that is there a way to bring these methods into the education schools? Maybe Aaron could talk about this. I know Relay is doing some of it, Hunter College, Johns Hopkins, and a lot of education schools are experimenting with, you know, videotaping teachers, evaluating their practice in the classroom, doing some kind of value-added measures, and having taken student teaching more seriously, and actually not graduating people unless they're proven to be effective teachers. And is there any, maybe Aaron, you could talk a little more about what's that.
Sure. I think there is a strong desire on the part of the people who are preparing teachers to find ways to have richer and deeper clinical experiences as part of the preparation, and that sometimes involves year-long internships or residencies in schools that are far more extensive than the traditional 10-week student teaching period, where teachers are embedded in settings where they have much more of an opportunity to both get support from mentor teachers and more experienced teachers, as well as to learn the local setting. I mean, one of the challenges, though, is that Teachers College, for example, has uncovered in its teacher residency program, which focuses on middle school ESL and special education teachers, is that it's hard to find schools that are willing that have the capacity to provide good mentorship. So that there's a capacity building problem throughout the system. If to the extent that we require or need really good mentors for clinical experiences, identifying sites that can serve as those settings is not an easy thing.
This gentleman right here.
Hi. There's a lot of research that says that among teachers who leave, highly effective teachers leave about the same rate as ineffective teachers. So it's not just that bad teachers are leaving, but teachers are leaving for a wide range of reasons. And the highest poverty schools have the largest teacher turnover rate. What do we do to attract teachers to the poorest schools, and how do we keep them from leaving when the communities in which they serve frequently a very difficult, high crime rates, all types of factors in the schools which are very discouraging, especially to young teachers? Because are there in middle schools now where the 5-year turnover rate is 50, 60, and 70%, even though the schools have principals who we think are doing a very good job?
Let me take a shot at this, and I'll speak from personal experience. I started a school on the Evander Childs campus. Evander, before it was phased out and before Bronx Lab, along with 5 other schools, started on that campus, had a graduation rate of roughly 30%, and would start every school year with scores of teacher vacancies. It had a core of teachers who had been there a very long time, but no one wanted to teach at that school. You know, fast forward to 2004, 5, 6, I opened a school with, in our first year, 6 teachers and 100 students, grew to call it, you know, 30 teachers and 450 students. And every year we would get 10 applications for every teacher vacancy we had, if not more.
Right? The school is the unit of change, and the school is what will attract talented educators to a very hard task, as you described. This is not easy work, even in a highly functional school. It is extraordinarily difficult and demands every ounce of a teacher's energy, their passion, and they go home bone tired. I lost a lot of great teachers that I would suggest I would not have lost with a $25,000 bonus, because you are right. I didn't just lose any teacher. I often lost my best teachers because the compensation wasn't what it needed to be for them to make the long-term investment to stay in the profession.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Gentleman in the back there.
I think there's been a repeated mischaracterization of the merit.
Including by Mark just now, which is that I don't think the city's proposing a $25,000 bonus for highly effective teachers. My understanding is that they're proposing a $25,000 salary increase for highly effective teachers.
Correct.
That gets baked into the salary.
Thank you, Micah.
And with that in mind, I guess I'd ask the panel, and specifically Professor Pallas, isn't it then a bit of a red herring to oppose that proposal on the basis of a lack of research that merit pay drives student achievement, when in fact this is basically a labor economics tool to attract and retain highly effective teachers?
Well, I think any education system has to make choices about where to invest its resources. And the question as to whether in fact that kind of incentive would really alter the behavior of effective teachers, I think, is an open one. We certainly have not seen evidence of a variety of performance-linked compensation plans across the country that just haven't had payoffs with regard to students' test scores. Now, obviously, there's a lot more that we might be thinking about besides students' test scores. So in a context where, you know, Chancellor Walcott stands before you with the threat that the system is going to have to implement mid-year budget cuts to schools because of if we fail to reach an agreement by January 17th, has to be juxtaposed with how resources might be used in other ways. And, you know, maybe the money that, which certainly doesn't exist now anyway, so it's kind of an open question. It's not clear where this money actually is coming from. I think the reality is that most teachers are incentivized by the desire to do a good job, but it is the case that there are plenty of places that don't provide adequate supports for them to do that. And I would think that more so than these kinds of performance bonuses or salary increments, the strategy that Mark described of capacity building, of sort of working to try to create a school culture and a team of teachers in a high-need school that will make it attractive enough to stay, is desirable. Now, it may be that we need incentives to get teachers and experienced principals into those schools in the first place, and there are some models for doing something like that. One of the best known being the Strategic Staffing Initiative in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. It's costly, it's time-consuming. Charlotte-Mecklenburg is a small district. New York City has so many schools that could benefit from this kind of approach. It's hard to know how to bring it to scale, but that strikes me in the long term as a much better investment than baking $25,000 increases into teachers who are judged effective.
If I can just, again, not mutually exclusive. I agree with everything you said. I mean, strategic staffing, and Charlotte's not such a small school district. You know, it's I think, the 10th or 12th largest in the country. And we have a lot to learn from what they did. I can tell you, I will not mention their names, but I have, you know, five teachers from my school who, with a $25,000 baked into their salary, thank you, Mr. Lasher, they would have stayed. And I think it's silly of us to think that that wouldn't matter to these tremendous educators who are worth it. So these things are not mutually exclusive in any way.
Okay. Please join me thanking all our panelists for a thoughtful discussion. Okay.